All right. We are back. I am back. Whatever this is, I'm in my office. Got the coffee. I'm not going to do the slurp. But we have been talking about Reformed theology here on this little podcast thing I'm doing, specifically talking about the five points of Calvinism. And last time, I introduced you to the first point, total depravity. I want to respond to a number of objections that I have heard through the years or that I have thought of myself. So I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit and try to throw out some questions and see how total depravity does under the scrutiny of some objections. But before I do that, I just want to review. Let's just review what we're talking about. Total depravity, it's describing mankind's fallen spiritual condition. We are, in our totality, corrupted, affected, damaged by sin. Remember, this is not teaching that people are as bad as they could possibly be. It just simply means every aspect of you, your mind, your heart, your behavior, your will, even your body, it's affected by sin's corrupting power. And I didn't mention this last time, but I need to take a second here and do so. Mankind, you and I, were not created like this. Genesis 1:26 says that we're created in God's image. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 29 says that God made man upright. So man's spiritual condition at creation was such that he was able to choose righteousness and able to choose sin. He had free will. His nature was such that he was able to choose sin, or he was able to renounce sin. But Adam, the first man, he chose to sin, and therefore mankind spiritually died at the fall. This fall into sin radically affected his nature and all of his descendants' natures. So in Colossians 2, verse 13, it says, "You were dead in your sins and in the uncircumcision of your sinful nature." In Matthew chapter 8, verse 22, says, Jesus says, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." He refers to human beings, fallen, sinful human beings, as dead people. And we looked at this last time. Ephesians 2, 1 through 3 says, "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins." Romans 6, 23 says, "For the wages of sin is death." This is why we talk about the fall. And the fall, I'm doing air quotes with the fall. It's why we talk about the fall. Mankind fell into sin and therefore died. Let's say that you walk into the lobby of like a skyscraper, and there is that second floor, you know, kind of that mezzanine floor. Let's say you take the elevator up to that mezzanine floor, the second floor, and you jump off and you fall to the first floor, and your bones are busted, you're kind of broken up, but you survive. But let's say that you take the elevator to the 92nd floor of this skyscraper, and then you decide to jump. You bust out, and you jump. Well, you would die at that point. And Calvinists' understanding of sin, which I think is the Bible's understanding of sin, is that sin has led you into a spiritual death because sin has corrupted mankind in his totality. He's not able to take a single step towards God. Not because God's restraining him, not because God doesn't want him to, but because of his sinful nature. I kind of heard this analogy growing up. If there are 100 steps between you and God, the gospel is that God goes 99 steps and he's right next to you and he's waiting for you just to take one. So that one step for you is just to step out in faith and to receive him as your savior. And what I appreciate about that analogy is that I appreciate the invitation of that analogy, the offer to respond to the gospel in faith. But the analogy breaks down. I think it fails because it assumes that you're able to take one step. But what I hope that you're getting from the Bible is that dead people can't do that. Dead people can't make decisions. If the T in total depravity is true, then we have to depend entirely on God for salvation. The work of salvation isn't divided between 99% of the work goes to God and 1% goes to you. I would say no, salvation is 100% God's work. This is why the book of Jonah says salvation is of the Lord. In fact, I think the other 4 points of what we're going to look at the rest of these podcasts, the other 4 points of Calvinism necessarily flow from the first point. People talk about being a four-point Calvinist. I'm a four-point Calvinist, kind of like this is a buffet. I'll just take this point. I'll pass on that point. But what I hope you're going to see is that I think that that's logically impossible. If you accept this first point, this first idea, that man is completely and utterly dependent on God for his salvation, then the other 4 follow suit. And if you keep listening, hopefully you'll see why that's the case. Okay, review session over. Let's look at some objections. And I'm going to try to anticipate some questions. Some of these were my own questions as I processed some of this when I was younger. These are some common objections that get raised. I'm going to do 3 today. 3. Here's number 1. If the fallen person is unable to obey God, then why is he commanded to do so? Is it fair to command him to do something that he is unable to do? So you see the question, you see the objection. The question is, okay, you Calvinists are saying man, human beings are unable to respond to the gospel in faith. Well, then why does God command you to respond to the gospel in faith? How can he command you to do something that you're unable to do? So you see the question? Well, if we go back to the 400s AD, the 400s, this is what a monk named Pelagius thought. He heard, the story goes that one time he heard St. Augustine praying a prayer that went like this. The prayer said, "Lord, grant what you command and command what you desire." God, I want you to grant what you command and then command the thing that you desire. And Pelagius was like, dude, that makes no sense. Why are you praying that God would grant the very thing that he's already commanded? If God commanded it, then he assumes that you're able to do it. Why would God command something from you if you're incapable of doing it? That's the question. There was this big debate between Pelagius and Augustine, and there was this church council that met in the city of Carthage in the year 418 AD. 418, to examine these issues with the Bible, and they declared that Pelagius's view, his objection, was wrong. Okay, why though? Well, they said there's a hidden assumption in that objection. That objection has an assumption kind of buried in it. And the objection assumes responsibility implies ability. I'll say it again. The objection assumes that responsibility implies ability. In other words, they're saying it's an unfounded assumption to assume that just because God requires something from me means that I can actually do it. Martin Luther would actually articulate this 1,000 years later when he would say, quote, "A command tells me what God requires of me, but it does not imply my ability to do it." All a command does is simply telling me what God requires of me, but it doesn't imply in any way that I'm able to do it. Our obligation to God is grounded in our being created in the image of our Creator. Okay? Our obligation to God is grounded in the fact that we're created in God's image. Before the fall, mankind had both the ability and the obligation to obey and please God. As a result of the fall, mankind lost the ability, but he is still obligated to obey and please God. The Bible never suggests that when we fell into sin, that somehow God lowered our obligation in any way to accommodate our fallen nature. So what's the point of God commanding a fallen sinner to obey him then when a fallen sinner can't? You understand the question? Why would God command somebody to obey him when they can't? Well, it is to reveal to you that you can't, and to show you that you need someone else to do it for you. This is the point of Galatians chapter 3, verse 19 through 25. The point of the law is to drive you to Christ, to show you I can't obey the law. I can't follow God on my own. I need help. I need rescue. So that's objection number one. Here's question number two, objection, question, issue number two. Goes like this.
If the natural man is unable to receive God, what's the point of sharing the gospel? I mean, doesn't this make evangelism unnecessary?
This is the big question I get a lot. I think this was the question I had as well. If you're telling me mankind, human beings, men and women, are unable to respond to the gospel, then why share it? What's the point? This kind of makes ministry and evangelism obsolete. Well, here is my response to that. Here's a response to that. God has ordained not just the ends of salvation, the E-N-D-S, the ends of salvation, but he's also ordained the means of salvation. Meaning, he has ordained the salvation of some people. That's the end result. It's the ends. But belief in the gospel never occurs inside of a vacuum. He's also ordained the means, the process by which he saves people. And God has ordained that the preaching and the sharing of the gospel is the means whereby he brings dead people to life. This is what Romans 10 says. Chapter 10, verse 12 through 15 is all about. The Spirit works through the Word. The gospel is the, quote, power of God. This is Romans chapter 1, verse 16. We're instructed by Jesus himself to inform others about the gospel and invite them to faith and repentance. And God uses the proclaimed Word, the proclaimed gospel, to do his work of bringing people to himself. And so our hope is not in man's ability to receive the gospel, but in God's ability to use the gospel to receive man. It's a big statement. Let me say it again. Our hope, the hope of anyone in ministry or any Christian really, is not in man's ability to receive the gospel, but in God's ability to use the gospel to receive man. In Matthew 19, verse 26, Jesus looked at them and said, "With man, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible." So, the Calvinist can share the gospel with utter urgency and confidence, knowing that the Spirit works through the Word as it goes forth. We don't know who will be saved, when they will be saved, but we proclaim the gospel to everyone, leaving the work of conversion up to God. I mean, without this confidence, I think you ultimately have to trust your own eloquence or your ability to be clear about the gospel. You have to trust in your persuasive abilities to convince a sinner to choose Christ. And that's just a ton of pressure. Now, what if you get a question and you don't know the answer to it? What if you mess up in your gospel presentation? What if somebody sees you sin or screw up or fail as a Christian? If you were to look up 2 Corinthians 4, verse 1 through 7, it says God changes hearts through jars of clay like us. So, why do we share the gospel? Because it's the ordained means, it's the ordained process by which God uses to save the people that he wants to save. Here's an amazing quote from J.I. Packer's book, evangelism and the sovereignty of God, which, by the way, if you're interested in hearing more about more of a response to this particular question, that little book, Evangelism and the Sovereignty of God, is a whole book devoted to trying to answer that question. Great, it's a great little book, but here's a great quote from it. It says, quote, "So persevere in presenting Christ to unconverted people as you find opportunity. You are not on a fool's errand. You are not wasting either your time or theirs. You have no reason to be ashamed of your message or half-hearted and apologetic in delivering it. You have every reason to be bold and free and natural and hopeful of success, for God can give his truth an effectiveness that you and I cannot give it." Okay, last question, last objection. And it's this one that we mentioned last week, last time.
Does this mean man does not have free will? Does total depravity mean we don't have free will?
And again, I got into this a little bit last time, but just to go a little bit deeper, again, it depends on what you mean. Most people define the phrase free will something like, it's the ability to make choices without any prior prejudice, inclination, or coercion. You're just free to make decisions and you're not restrained in any way whatsoever. The problem with that is getting at why someone would make the choices they make. Have you ever thought about this? Why do you make the choices you make? Why did you choose to wear what you're wearing today? It was your preference. Why did you choose to eat what you ate today? It was your preference. Why did you come to the University of Tennessee? It was your preference. Why are you listening to this podcast right now? It was your preference. Your internal desires are determining your decisions. And the Bible seems to say that's absolutely true. You can choose what you want to choose. The problem is, fallen, sinful people only want to choose sinful things. And we looked at lots of passages last week that was all very depressing with the piano music, but it showed us we are slaves to sin. Fallen man only wants to sin because that's what is inherent to fallen sinful nature. I am not free to breathe water because that is not consistent with my human nature. People who are not reborn or born again, born of the Spirit, they are not free to choose God because that's inconsistent with their nature. They don't want to choose God. As Romans 8, 6 through 8 puts it, quote, "The sinful mind is hostile to God. It does not submit to God's law, nor can it do so." So I think a better definition of the phrase free will would be to define it this way. It is the ability to make choices according to your desires. Or you could say, according to your nature. Free will is the ability to make choices according to your desires or to your nature. And look, think about this. If this is still bizarre to you, if you're thinking like, that's not how I understand freedom or my will. Okay, think about these concepts, but relate them to God. Let's apply my little template and apply it to God himself. Does God have free will? I would say, yes, of course God has free will. He is completely free to do whatever he wants. But I would say he's also bound, if you can even use that word, he's bound to his nature, meaning God is unable to sin. Does that mean that God isn't free? No, of course he's free. It's just simply inconsistent with his nature to sin. So I would say yes, both believers and unbelievers, Christians and non-Christians have free will. I would just make the distinction. A Christian has a regenerated will, a born-again will, a new creation kind of will. and the other has an unregenerated will. Here's a quote from the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is a theological document that was written in the 1600s. But here's what this document says, which I think is helpful. This is chapter 9, section 3, paragraph 3. Reads this, quote, "When God converts a sinner and translates him into the state of grace, he frees him from his natural bondage under sin, and by his grace alone enables him freely to will and to do that which is spiritually good. Yet so, as that by reason of his remaining corruption, he does not perfectly nor only will that which is good, but does also will that which is evil. The will of man is made perfectly and immutably free to do good alone in the state of glory only." Now that is a lot of words and was probably very confusing, but here may be a helpful way to break down that quote. And actually, this is a concept that this man named Thomas Boston came up with. He said, think about the fourfold state of human beings. You know, if you think about a Christian's storyline, if the storyline of redeemed humanity kind of goes through four different chapters, four different stages. Here's stage number one, creation. This is before mankind fell into sin. And you could say human beings are able to sin and they are able to not sin. The second chapter of the story, the second state of man, would be the fall. Post-fall human beings are unable to not sin, meaning a person in their fallen state is unable to not sin. He can only choose sin. Okay? Chapter three, or the third state of mankind, is redemption. Man is reborn by the Spirit. This is, you know, if you're listening to this and you happen to be a Christian, this is Christians who live their lives before glory. They are able to sin, but they're also able to not sin. If you think about your own life, you are now able as a believer to say no to sin. This is what Titus chapter 2 says. But you're also able to choose sin, which you and I do all the time. We do both. We're torn. We're in this tension, this mixture, this battle. But then the last state, the last kind of chapter in the story is glory. Glorified human beings are unable to sin. In glory, in heaven, you will not have the ability to sin. It will be against your glorified nature to rebel against God in any way. Does this mean that when you're in heaven, you don't have free will? No, you just have a completely redeemed and glorified nature. So those are three responses to three common questions and objections with the whole total depravity thing. So we'll kind of close the chapter on that point for now, and next time we'll take on what may even be a bigger topic, the topic of election and predestination.